So good morning, everyone, and welcome to John Jay. Welcome to the Guggenheim Symposium. I'm Jeremy Travis. I'm the president of the college. I'm delighted to see all of you here, many old friends who come every year. It's good to see you here at the Guggenheim Symposium again, and to people coming to the college for the first time, welcome to icy, slippery, yucky New York weather. Sorry that this is what you're putting up with. I'll be brief and have a couple of purposes. First, I want to just talk a bit about the purpose of the Guggenheim Symposium. This is our 10th year of this symposium. It's the 50th year of John Jay College, so we're celebrating a number of anniversaries this year. The purpose of the symposium is fairly straightforward. It's to bring together journalists and scholars and other experts outside of the day-to-day crush of breaking news stories, headlines, whatever else occupies the time of journalists and occasionally scholars, to talk about the cutting-edge issues in criminal justice of the day. The second-level purpose is pretty clear, I think, which is to, by doing that, to provide an opportunity for journalists to take a deep dive into issues that where they might not otherwise have that opportunity, might not have been given that time. And this is in part in recognition of the fact, the sad and unavoidable fact, that the industry of journalism is under a lot of pressure, and it's harder to find that time. It's harder to find time to do the deeper stories. So we are your colleagues in that sense, and hoping that this is a contribution that that we and our sponsors can make to the quality and the sophistication and the originality of journalistic coverage of these issues. We're biased, those of us in the criminal justice world, we think these are really important issues. So that's the starting point, is that we think if they're given better treatment by our friends in the journalism world, that there'll be a better public understanding of these complex issues. So as often is the case with things that happen in New York and other places, the origin of the Guggenheim Symposium can be traced to a lunch that I had a little over 10 years ago with my friend and colleague over many years, Joel Wallman, from the Guggenheim Foundation. And Joel and I were talking. I just arrived at John Jay, trying to think about what I wanted to do with this place, and I've always had an interest in supporting journalism. And we hatched this idea over lunch that we would create something named after his foundation, the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation, where he was the senior program officer. And an idea was born, and it continues 10 years later. So first and foremost, let me just ask you to recognize with me Joel Wallman and his foundation for providing this opportunity now for 10 years. We get to see each other at least once a year, which is cool. Joel, as you might know, is with Al Blumstein, co-author of the really groundbreaking book more than 10 years ago on understanding the declining crime rates in America. So we have handled a number of difficult topics at the Guggenheim Symposium. There's a theme each year. Last year, it was about economic issues, and our keynote speaker kicking it off was Bill Bratton, talking about the role of policing and promoting economic development. We've been talking about the incarceration challenges that our country faces. We've talked about issues of the crime decline, trying to understand what's happening in crime in America. And this year's theme is race, justice, and community. Talk about timely. So I really appreciate that Steve Handelman, who I'll introduce in a second, and his team have chosen this and organized the conference around that theme for the reasons that are, I think, obvious to all of us. So how does the symposium work? We invite journalists to come and spend a couple days here in New York at John Jay, listening, engaging with experts, talking to each other. But they have to come with a story idea. They're sent by their editors. This is not just a trip to New York. They're working. And they come with a story idea, and then tomorrow we'll develop their story idea working with some of our veteran journalists like Joe Dominic and Kara Tabachnik and Steve Handelman and others to help flesh out that idea. And the proof in this pudding is that over the 10 years, a number of those ideas have become really great stories or NPR coverage or we do more things on blogs these days or on TV. So we're very pleased with the with the success of the Guggenheim Symposium over the past 10 years. We've also been successful in sort of expanding the format. Not only do we have the annual symposium here, but we also have workshops on special topics that are held either here in New York at John Jay or around the country. And those are a deeper dive on an even narrower area, on pretrial justice, on three strikes and you're out in California, on healthcare and the like. Speaking of which, where are my friends from Langeloth Foundation? Just want to, we thank you for your support of the work we've done on health and justice issues. And over the 10 years, here's the sort of the drum roll, the Center of Media Crime and Justice, which Steve heads up, has worked with 600 journalists. It's just an amazing engagement, partnership between John Jay and the experts who are here and our colleagues in journalism. And we're very, very pleased with that success. We also have this year a partnership with the Quattrone Center at University of Pennsylvania. And I'm not sure if John Holloway is here yet or not. Not, but we'll thank him at the appropriate time. And with their support, we have expanded the number of reporting fellows who are here. So the reporting fellows, all of their bios are listed in the program. They are the journalists here who are here listening with special interest. There are 20 of them this year, four of them Quattrone fellows, the others are Guggenheim fellows. So since you're here doing the hardest work, can I just ask, I know I'm guessing a lot of you over here, just to stand and be recognized, the reporters, the fellows, reporting fellows who are here, just stand. I know you're not used to getting this recognition, right? So. We're really delighted that you're here, and our job is to help you do your work. So please feel free to call on any of us. We have another aspect of our work with journalists, which is that each year we give a prize. Actually, two prizes to journalists who receive the prize for the John Jay Prize for Excellence in Criminal Justice Journalism, and that has also been a way of recognizing the good work that is done by our colleagues, and those prizes will be given out tonight. A final word is that we also connect through the network of criminal justice journalists with criminal justice journalists around the country. And that is managed by our colleague, Ted Guest, who is also here. Hi, Ted. Nice to see you, who has been working at this on this beat for a long time, many years at U.S. News and World Report, and was my first partner in launching this initiative. And through that partnership, we've also created the crimereport.org, which I assume that all of you are aware of, write for, follow religiously. We're trying to use that as the main platform for criminal justice journalism and encouraging academics to write for it as well. So there's a lot going on. All of this is managed by a really wonderful team here at the college that heads up the Center on Media Crime and Justice, which is also celebrating its 10th year anniversary this year. And its director is someone well known to all of you, journalist of great renown, has covered crime and corruption from Russia to Latin America, written a book on the Russian mafia, written for Toronto Star, did I get it right? Okay. And many other publications, and is my partner in all of this work that we do here to promote good journalism. So please join me in welcoming the one, the only, Steve Handelman. All right.
I just want to, to amend what Jeremy's remarks, Adam Gelb has just come in, who we also want to thank through the Pew Charitable Trusts for their support of the conference this year, as they have every year. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking. You'll be glad to know. All of you deserve good conduct medals for making it through this morning's ICE. People will still be coming in through the morning, but welcome to everybody. Good morning. We will have a hugely exciting program for you today and tomorrow. I hope you can stay with us tomorrow. In fact, you may have to if it still snows and ice. But if I read off everyone, every biography of the folks who are here, including the fellows and our speakers, it would occupy a whole hour of one of our panels. So I'm not going to do that, but you have it all in your folders and in the agenda. So we're going to start, if I can ask the panelists for the first panel to come up. I just wanted to give you a quick sense of the mechanics and the dynamics of the conference. These are all open conferences. Everything's on the record. What we try to do is leave sufficient time at the end of the panel discussion for you to ask questions and have a little bit of exchange. And we're really, really honored at the quality of the speakers we have for this year's session. As you'll see, the theme is kind of a throwback. I mean, it's intentional to ask the question of, can we all get along? Race, justice, community, it goes back to the Rodney King era when we thought people could answer that question. Yes, we could get along. Clearly, over the last year, that question has come up again, both in a number of areas in criminal justice, whether not just in police-community relations, but across the whole field, corrections, courts. So we're going to be exploring a lot of those areas this week. And obviously, we don't have answers to them, but we hope that what you'll get and pick up from some of the discussions are some ideas, some provoking, thought-provoking possibilities for you to take with you back to your work, those of you who are journalists, those of you who are academics and practitioners. And the idea, as Jeremy said, of these conferences is to keep a conversation going. It's one of the unique forum that occur in the field of criminal justice where journalists and academics and practitioners cross the various boundaries and start talking to each other. And we've been doing this for the last 10 years. It's very successful, and we've had huge numbers of stories and research projects as a result. So it works. So for this panel, which is our first thematic panel, we're really pleased to have as a moderator Bill Frivogel, or Frivogel, right? Frivogel. Bill is a professor in the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University. He's publisher of the Gateway Journalism Review, and he's a contributor to St. Louis Public Radio. He's a veteran journalist. He's going to tell us a little bit about post-Ferguson and during Ferguson, and then we're going to have a discussion that goes a little bit beyond just Ferguson. We're calling it the lessons from a tragedy, but we're going to be ranging far and wide. So, Bill, the floor is yours.
Please join me in welcoming Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome, everybody. Ted Guest and I go back a long ways. 45 years ago, we were in the newsroom of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That was a day unlike what was described earlier, a day when there were reporters shoulder to shoulder, basically, in the newsroom. But that didn't, even though it was the golden age of journalism, that didn't mean we always were the most in-depth. Ted and I were recalling that one of our tasks every Saturday or Saturday night was to call up all the municipal police departments, including Ferguson, before Ferguson anybody knew where Ferguson was. And, you know, it would be just anything happening? And the answer was almost always no. And Ted was joking before that quite possibly on August 9th, if we'd been following that practice, the Ferguson Police Department would have said nothing's going on. The question I'm most often asked about Ferguson, actually, I got it from a graduate student the other day. I teach in Carbondale, which is about 100 miles south of St. Louis, and she looked at me really concerned, and she said, I told her I was going back home at the end of the day. She looked at me really concerned and said, is it safe for you to go back there? And, this made me feel as though, well, maybe we in the media have given a little bit of the wrong impression about Ferguson, as important as it is. But the other question that I most often get is why Ferguson, within a few days last summer, went from being the obscure name of a quiet, well-integrated suburb in St. Louis to a word that around the world came to symbolize everything that's wrong with America. I think it's a combination of a number of things. Leaving Michael Brown dead on the street for 4 hours, the failure to immediately name the police officer who shot Brown, the similar deaths of other black men at the hands of police, creating a critical mass of tragedies of that kind, police with dogs reminiscent of the era of Bull Connor, police in military gear with military vehicles and red laser beams focused on protesters' chests, failure to respect the First Amendment of citizens and journalists. As PEN America documented in their complaint, police tried to ban nighttime protests, tried to ban protests where people were standing still, and arrested some journalists and threatened others. But most importantly, I think Ferguson reminded us that we have not solved many of the problems, many of the racial problems in this country that we had hoped that we had gotten past. Michael Brown, after all, graduated from an almost all-black high school in St. Louis that had lost its state accreditation. It was such a bad high school. The mayor of that racially integrated city was white. Most of the city council was white. Most of the police department was white. And 50 years after Selma, the African-American voting participation in Ferguson was barely noticeable and of little effect. And don't forget, this was all playing out in a place that's long been a stage for important racial struggles. Just think Missouri Compromise, Elijah Lovejoy, Dred Scott. It's a place that had the biggest, most expensive school desegregation program in the country, one that was fought tooth and nail by the person who is now in charge of overseeing all these Ferguson, Governor Jay Nixon. And it's the place where the nation's biggest housing discrimination cases were set. Shelley versus Kramer, banning restrictive covenants that locked blacks into a small ghetto in St. Louis. Jones versus Mayer, involving the right of a African-American to buy a house in a suburb just a little north of Ferguson. I'm glad that largely because of press attention, Ferguson has become a symbol and a reason to reappraise our racial progress, not just in St. Louis, but as a nation. I'm glad the nation didn't try to muscle forward through the 21st century, thinking that the racial sins of the 20th and the 19th and the 18th and the 17th centuries had been expunged. But I sometimes have cringed at some of the press coverage. Fox misreported that Brown had broken Officer Wilson's eye socket. Ferguson was portrayed as a symbol of segregation when it's actually one of the most integrated suburbs in St. Louis. The New York Times reported the name of the street on which Darren Wilson had lived and then refused to admit to its ethical breach. Radley Balco, in an otherwise powerful blog in the Washington Post, claimed falsely that many suburban districts have been created in St. Louis to keep blacks out. ProPublica published an influential data analysis concluding that young African-American men were 21 times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts over a three-year period they studied. Most of the mainstream media picked up that report as gospel. Few paid attention to Peter Moskos of John Jay, who pointed out that the disparity was so great partly because of the way ProPublica had sliced and diced the data. Few national media wanted to recognize that there might be something positive to say about prosecuting attorney Bob McCullough's decision to bring all the evidence before the grand jury and to release all of the grand jury transcripts. And when the press showed up at McCullough's press conference that night of the rioting, when he announced there was going to be no indictment, they put on what I thought was the most pitiful performance of the media that I've ever seen. Three reporters asked the same question. It was really an unanswerable question. What was the vote of the grand jury? McCullough wasn't going to answer that. And then another reporter got up and began his question with a polemic about how the law, we now know the law doesn't protect African Americans. Then after we at St. Louis Public Radio reported that McCullough had changed the legal instructions to the grand jury at the last minute, making it easier to indict Wilson, not harder, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell distorted what had actually happened, and his distortions were picked up by a liberal media echo chamber. Overall, the national media followed a narrative trail that prejudged Wilson as guilty based on initial unreliable witness accounts to the media. The story of the gentle giant on his way to college who had his hands up in a don't-shoot surrender mode and who was supposedly shot in the back by police didn't entirely hold up under scrutiny. I soon realized that the tragic death, as tragic as the death of Michael Brown was, the decision about whether Darren Wilson was prosecuted was really not the most important decision facing St. Louis. While there may not have been enough evidence, or there may have been enough evidence to indict Darren Wilson, there's plenty of evidence that Wilson mishandled his confrontation with Michael Brown. Instead of driving past Brown until he got back up over the radio, he blundered into a direct confrontation. The same can be said of the officers in Cleveland who barreled up too close to a young man with a fake gun. So the importance of police strategies and tactics and police community relations is key, I came to conclude. And that was especially clear to me after I went to Cincinnati to see how that city had come back from a similar period of unrest following the police shooting of an unarmed black teen in 2001. I met Iris Rowley there, one of the leaders of the United Front. She told me how she had cried the day that she was told that this was the building police community trust was the job of not months and not years, but many years, and now it's been more than a decade. Iris doesn't claim that everything's fixed in Cincinnati, but the city's collaborative agreement, its problem-oriented policing, its commitment to immediately release the names of police shooters, its citizens' review process have created an atmosphere of greater trust between the black community and city leaders. Iris testified last month at the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing will tell you her story. Our other three panelists are cutting-edge thinkers about new police approaches. David Kennedy of John Jay founded the Network for Safe Communities and himself spent part of his time in Cincinnati with a program focused on hardened criminals who commit a disproportionate number of violent acts. Kansas City Police Chief Daryl Forte has implemented a strategy of focused deterrence that also centers on groups of hardened criminals. The chief has been skillful in reaching out to the community through social media and other means. Finally, we have Professor Sam Walker of the University of Nebraska, whom I have known as a leading expert on civilian review and police accountability. Dr. Walker will expand on his testimony before the President's Commission, where he talked about his respectful policing initiative. So we've got problem-oriented policing, focused deterrence, community policing, respectful policing, networks for safe communities. I hope this discussion will help us understand those and tell us something about how we can address the serious problems that Ferguson symbolizes without having another town's name suddenly transformed into an international symbol of injustice. We're going to just go right down the row here in order. So, Chief, can you start us out?
Good morning. And I can tell you there's a problem in the other segments of the community because there's a problem inside the police organizations. Most of the organizations that I talk to, the leaders, they're mostly run by middle-aged white males and I can talk about Kansas City, Missouri. I'm not going to talk about everybody else because I know about Kansas City. They're run by middle-aged white males, and they have been. I'm the first African-American chief, and mostly they surround themselves by people that look and think like them. And that creates problems. And I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. I'm not going to use a lot of time, so we can have questions at the end. And I'll touch on a number of topics. We want to keep the community safe and not just keep them safe, but make them feel safe. And oftentimes when you talk about the African-American community, especially those that felt like they've been dealt the short end of the stick, they're waiting sometimes for a reason to do some things, just like we've seen recently. That didn't happen overnight. Those things were building up. Years ago, I started to build and nurture relationships. We all know about Rodney King in 1992, and nobody should be shocked about Ferguson right now. Nobody should be shocked. You know, it could happen in any given city. I think we have a great relationship in Kansas City, but it can happen anywhere in Kansas City also. We're not out of the woods. We talk about focused deterrence, and thanks to David Kennedy, he came to Kansas City probably in 2003, and we had a team of leaders, and I love them all. Don't get me wrong. I learned a lot from them, but came to Kansas City. We started that process to get focused deterrence in Kansas City. People didn't buy into it. We didn't have prosecutors to buy into it. We didn't have our other federal partners to buy into it and things like that. So again, we can see a lot of these things coming, and nobody should be surprised. And I got to keep my notes going here because it keeps cutting out. And you talk about focus deterrence, and people oftentimes when you talk about focus deterrence, they worry about what the other segments of the community is going to think about that. And I don't talk about the community because we're all one, so I say other segments of the community most of the time. And we had no pushback on focus deterrence. Matter of fact, people applauded that in some of these urban areas where we've had rampant crime, especially homicides. This is the first time in 2014 that we were under 100 homicides in years. We had 78. And last year we had, or 2013, we had 100. So again, we had that community support. We got very little pushback. And I remember when Mr. Kennedy came to Kansas City before in the early 2000s, we had some pastors that didn't buy into that. We started talking about hotspot policing. People didn't want to buy into that because they thought we'd have the white police officers, because the majority of our police officers are white, would go into these neighborhoods and wreak havoc with our young black males. The last chief couldn't get it done, but again, in 1992, I started building relationships as a sergeant with some of the pastors out there, and there's about 10 people I call every month where the things are going well or not so well, and I talk to them about what's going on in the community. When I became chief and before I became chief, I went around and talked to some of these guys and said, this is what I'm going to do if I become chief. I wasn't getting their permission or anything, but I explained the benefits of that, and they all supported me, and nobody has come out and said anything negative about it. Not a single person. It's about building those relationships before you need something. That's so important, because oftentimes when I go around and I do these community surveys, I do one-on-one surveys in the community with people, and I've done that since I was a sergeant years ago. And they'll tell you one-on-one what they really need. We hold community forums now, and this is before Ferguson or any other incident. We hold community forums, and we don't get the mic. We give the mic to the people in other segments of the community, and they tell us what they want and what they need. And I think that's important, too. Listen before something comes up, and you can prevent a lot of things. When you talk about the civil unrest, we've had protests, marches, and things like that. And we most of the time, people called us and said, hey, Daryl, we're going to march. How do we do this legally? The first person that called me was probably one of our most radical faith-based leaders in town and said, hey, we want to do this the right way. They're the first ones to call us. We go and we help set it up. We tell them the rules. We've been careful in how we phrase things, very careful. We don't talk about responding to resistance. We talk about we'll engage at the level necessary. We'll walk you through. We've even given people rides back. They walk so far without a plan, and it's cold outside. We get a bus, and we take them back to where they originated from. Little things like that make a difference. That gave us a lot of positive coverage. But when you talk about racism, and we don't really talk about community policing, we just do it. If you Google or do any kind of search on community policing, there's so many different definitions. And instead of us calling it philosophy, we call it a practice. And all of us practice that. At least we're trying to get there. Everybody don't practice it because everybody don't really understand the problem solving and the partnerships. And then holding people accountable. We have community contracts where if you have a problem in your area, we want you to sign a contract with us and say, this is what you're willing to do. This is what we'll do. And then we'll come back and we'll get together and we'll talk about how we're making progress on that. A shot spotter system. People fought that before. And that's a gunshot detection system where if there's gunfire in a particular area and they're placed mainly in our hotspot areas, about 2.5 square miles around the city. If there's a gunshot, before people didn't call. And I can tell you this, my grandmother lived in her house for 55 years. She lives in the urban core. I was over there one day and we heard gunfire and she didn't even duck. She said, oh, that's just so-and-so down the street. They shoot every day around noon. And that's how immune some people are and they live in those neighborhoods. So we have the gunshot detection system. Now we show up because when there's gunfire in some areas, we show up and people come out like, what, you know, how did you all know? Because they didn't call, they've been shooting for years. Little things like that, that builds trust. That builds trust so when things like Ferguson comes up, they say, hey, our police care. We've actually wounded and killed unarmed black males since I've been chief the last 3 years. We've done some. You know what? When I first get on the phone, I call the pastors and some of the other people in the neighborhood and say, this is what happened. We don't know for sure. We killed a guy, and I went to the hospital, and I talked to the victim, the suspect's father, because he did something to us, so he's a suspect. And I talked to his father, and he said, Daryl, I trust you because you're the chief, and I know it's going to be a fair investigation. You know what that means? That means a lot. Everybody's not going to be like that. Don't get me wrong. It's going to be some people want to fight me and all that other kind of stuff. But you got some people out there where you build those relationships over the years, and it makes a difference. So, again, trust. And, again, I talk about internal racism. When you talk about the police department, I don't want to say we're a racist police department, but we're just like everybody else. We have biases, so we can't – and we haven't discussed this a lot inside until I became chief – We talk about it every time I get the microphone at a board meeting, at community forums where we're talking. I talk about the issues we have inside. I talk about internal bullying. And the first time I blogged about that, and I do a blog occasionally where I write my own, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, it's just on my heart. So I wrote a long blog about internal bullying and said no more, because we can't go out there and be fair and treat the community with respect if we're not doing it inside. So I talk about it all the time. I talk about going from fear-based management inside to respect-based management, because we're from the old school, a lot of us. I've been on 29 years. You call somebody in, you have somebody with you, and then you just basically berate them, saying, you're not going to do this if you do this again. I told people now, when you walk out, if you have a commander or sergeant that's talking to you in a derogatory manner, you have permission to walk out and then call me, and then we'll have a meeting together. We're going to treat each other with respect inside the organization, because if you don't do it inside, I have two African-American commanders. All they do is ride around in the field, and these are majors. They have no other responsibility to ride around in the field and stop and talk to people, police officers and other segments of the community, and ask, what's going on? Why did you stop this person? Why did you do this? And when the officer is finished, they can stop the other person and say, how did they treat you? That's their only job. And I did that within 3 days of being appointed chief. Just one more minute, because I know everybody else want to talk. And again, I talk about the riots. When you talk about the riots in Kansas City, I was 5 years old in 1968. You talk about the riots in Kansas City. 1967, we had 66 homicides in Kansas City. The year of the riots, we jumped up to 99 homicides. And then 1969, we had 116. We had never gone over 100 homicides since 1928. So that showed me then, when you look at these numbers, and I was a sergeant, captain, and major in the homicide unit over the years, I'm thinking, that tells us something. Rodney King, 1992, April, when the four officers were acquitted, we had 152 homicides in 1992. And guess what? 1993, the highest number recorded in Kansas City was 153. Guess what that told me again? When people don't trust you, that you police, that they take it into their own hands. Nothing difficult to figure out. And again, thanks to David Kennedy, when we started this real focused deterrence piece this time, because we had people that had buy-in, the ones that didn't have buy-in, they had to leave, because I knew the value in it. And again, focused deterrence, hotspot policing, shot spotter, gunshot detection system, all that has helped us reduce gunshot or violent crime in Kansas City. But again, if you don't have trust, cameras, let me just throw this out there. Now I'll stop. I got a lot to talk about, but let me throw this out there. If you can put all the cameras you want out there, if people don't trust you, they're going to talk about the footage was altered and a whole bunch of other things. You got to have trust. And we have a work group I put together so we can start studying those body-worn cameras. And we're going to bring people in from ACLU. We don't want it just to be a police thing, because we're going to tell you we think it's greatness as it should be. That we've always been arrogant, because why? You know why? Because there's nothing you can do to me. You can't get me fired. We got a House Bill 307. Unless I get caught drunk driving or do some felony, you can't get me fired. So I think a lot of times when we're in law enforcement, we know there's very little you can do other than complain, and it's not going to impact my income. So we got to be real careful on things like that. We, meaning leaders in the organizations, and being responsive to people and listening to people. So again, when you talk about the cameras, I know people are screaming cameras, and they have, you know, don't have plans and don't have a strong administrative piece on that. When do you turn them off? In Missouri, you can, if I would come to your house and you reside in Missouri, the neighbors can ask for the footage, things like that. So we're going through all those things. And again, without trust, there's going to be problems with that, too. So that's not the magic answer. So I'll be quiet now. Thank you.
You ready? Good morning, everybody. Thank you. I need to hear it back. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you. So thank you for inviting me into your icy cold town. I want to thank the John Jay College and the HF Guggenheim Symposium for inviting me to speak this morning. So my attempt today, I am going to attempt to take you through the lens of a project manager of a grassroots advocacy group, specifically for African Americans in the city of Cincinnati. And I want to do that because I want you to see the lens of policing through our eyes so that we can understand together how Cincinnati was, the changes that we did, and where we are today, and how we are continuing to still build. And it's going to be very difficult following the chief of police. But you did good. You did good.
Thank you.
A couple of housekeeping items. to help guide you through this journey with me this morning. The work that was done in Cincinnati didn't start with the Cincinnati Black United Front or the ACLU or the grassroots organizations that popped up after the 13th and 14th killing of an unarmed black man in the city of Cincinnati. It had been organized. Folk had been screaming. Folk wanted change for a very long time. The conditions that were created in Cincinnati just didn't happen in 2001. That stage was set many, many years, many, many decades ago. So we had a lot of work to do. And it definitely just didn't start because Iris Rowley was born on the front line. My family is a family of activists in the city of Cincinnati, so it's in my DNA to confront systems, human systems that are supposed to work for all that don't, to help them become better. Because once you help the systems become better, then the people can be better. So there were many hands in stirring this pot long before Iris Rowley, long before the Cincinnati Black United Front. We just stood on those shoulders to continue the work. So today I'm going to use the terms African Americans and black people because that is what the class says inside of our collaborative agreement, this wonderful document that you've heard so much about throughout the conversations around police reform these last couple of months, because some of us use different terminologies for identification. So I want you to understand that when I say African Americans and black people, I'm talking about the same people. And also, the last thing I want you to understand is that I am extremely proud and very arrogant in the change that occurred in Cincinnati, Ohio. And through our arrogancy, we decided in 2001 that black lives mattered then. And through our arrogancy, we were very, very unaware of how difficult and how challenging creating change through a culture of policing it was going to be. But through our arrogance, we developed something that we are extremely proud of. We developed something that we believe that other cities can use as a model. We developed something that produces community will, not just to look at policing, because policing shouldn't be someone's sole day. It shouldn't be so huge and ginormous in my life that I can't think about anything else, that I can't think about running my business. I can't think about raising my children. I can't think about having a long, productive marriage. I can't think about other systems that need my attention. It shouldn't be that way. So in 2001, the Cincinnati Black United Front was formed, and we were formed because 13 downtown restaurants that get our tax dollars to build the facades and for furniture, equipment, and fixtures, and paint, and bricks and mortars, decided that they were going to close during a very, very high revenue-generated event called the Cincinnati Jazz Festival. I don't know if any of you all have attended that, but it is, I believe, in its 50th year coming up. So when these 13 downtown restaurants that had received our tax dollars decided to close, the community was up in arms because this was a huge event. And as I said, it generated the most revenue out of all the public events that Cincinnati had. So when they decided to close, we decided to organize. But during that time, while we were dealing with that issue, we had what we still call 2 in 24. Two African-American men that were killed at the hands of the Cincinnati Police Department in 24 hours. The city was already boiling. We just didn't know it. Jeffrey Irons, Roger Owensby. Jeffrey Irons, Roger Owensby. Why was those two men so important and became the catalyst for change? They became the catalyst of the community saying to us, please redirect your focus. We want to understand how we can fix the problem with policing and the black community. And so we did. Roger Owensby, and I'm going to talk about Roger Owensby because in the media, The media never talked about Roger Owensby being a veteran, being home only 6 months. He had done two tours of duty. He was the only parent raising his daughter, and he was home for 6 months before the police said he looked like someone else. Roger Owensby was killed by a chokehold. That was in November of 2000. So when the community asked us to refocus, we said we would. And what we found out was startling. We found out from 1995 to 2000, 15 unarmed black men had been killed in those 5 years. We found out that the same answers were given each and every time, that these deaths were justifiable. That's it. That's all. No more conversation. No more looking at policy and procedure. No more talking to community through the deaths of people who were being killed by systems who are supposed to protect all in a very unbiased way. We found out that there were additional lawsuits in federal court. We found out that there were two attorneys that had done a 30-year study of policing in the Black community. So we hooked up with those attorneys because they were very smart guys. And we also found out that it was the right time to do something. It was the right time to do something. So it became our job. It became our volunteer job to decide how could we fix a problem? How, as taxpayers, do we get a better return on our investment? How, as citizens, do we help police understand policing in our community and what we needed and what we wanted? We knew it wasn't going to be easy. We knew it wasn't going to be quick. We knew it was going to be extremely hard because policing, for all intents and purposes, historically in the Black community, was one of unfairness, occupying, unexplained arrests, sweeps, just crazy mayhem. And no one answered for it. No one answered for it. So we knew that it was going to take some very special people to do the right thing across the board. It wasn't just Iris Rowley. Like I said, there were many hands inside of this pot. So while we were determining what we were going to do in Cincinnati, as we were sitting at the table and we had these two wonderful attorneys that would attend our meetings on a monthly basis and ask us, can we help? Please let us help. We are here to help. And we said, no. We don't need any more white help in the Black community. We needed to figure this out. We needed to figure it out. But as the Creator would have it, those two white attorneys knew what they were talking about. They knew exactly what we needed and how we could get it done. That was Scott Greenwood and Al Gerhardstein. So I hope some of you know these great men that have done phenomenal work. Al Gerhardstein is a civil rights attorney. Scott Greenwood is legal counsel for the ACLU. And then our local law dog, as we call him, Ken Lawson, joined our what we call our dream team. So what we did was we had to determine what was really going on in the city of Cincinnati. And what did Black folks think? What did they want? So in January of 2001, I became project manager for the Cincinnati Black United Front, designed a program that we would collect stories to see really what was going on. What were we working with? How could we fix it? What were people thinking? What were they feeling? Who had been abused? Who had not? Who had thoughts? We collected over 400 stories. And I may add that that was the most humbling time in my adult life because no one had ever asked African Americans in the city of Cincinnati how they felt about policing. No one had ever asked them what they thought and how they felt policing should police their community. So we had grandmothers, grandfathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, boyfriends, girlfriends, aunts and uncles. Out of five Saturdays, 400 people showed up with stories, documentation, tears. But there was hope because people wanted change. So while we were doing that and we collected the 400 stories and we turned them over to our wonderful dream team of attorneys. Oh, and by the way, we had one of the most fabulous federal judges in the country, Susan Dillot, in the Sixth Circuit Court, who told us that if we could show a pattern in practice, that we can then file a class action lawsuit. But while we were doing that, we had number 15, Timothy Thomas, 19-year-old unarmed Black man killed by Cincinnati police. Now, let's just go back for a second. We just filed a federal lawsuit in March of 2001. I want you all to hear me because the press gets it wrong all the time, and I get mad about that. You say the collaborative came as a result of the civil unrest, of the riots. No, we filed in March of 2001. Timothy Thomas was killed April 7th of 2001. So what do we do with this big boom in the middle of working, of the middle of trying to bring people together, in the middle of collaboration, in the middle of studying how do we fix community police relations, in particular in the Black community? Because there were many, many non-Black folks in the city of Cincinnati who were very clear that policing in Cincinnati was different from one segment of the population as opposed to the other. And they wanted change, and they wanted to help. How would we get through this now very, very hard, harsh reality that even in that time when you're sitting down and you're trying to figure it out, that something else would occur? How do you do that? We just didn't stop. We brought in that family into our lawsuit and said, let us take care of you as well, Mrs. Leisure. Let's make sure that whatever happened to Timothy Thomas doesn't happen again by way of policy, procedures, and guidelines. Make sure the community is in the room and at the table. Let's make sure that we all understand and that we all have the burden of better policing in our city, not just the police. Police are community people as well. They work at the hands of the city, of taxpayers. So we needed to be engaged. So how did we move forward? Because we had our 3 days of civil unrest. People, the youth took to the street because then they had had enough. They were feeling hopeless and occupied and as if nobody cared and there was nowhere to turn. Talking about building trust, you can't build it in that environment. You cannot build it in that environment. We had started something and we were determined to fix it. So as I said, we had collected over the 400 stories, went in the federal court, filed the lawsuit, then Timothy Thomas. But we believed it was bigger, it was greater, and that we needed to continue on. So our attorneys, the city, the police union, of which we invited to sit at the table with us, that's why it's called a collaborative, we kind of made it up. At first, for a long time, I thought, well, no, that's a problem. That's a process, right? No, we kind of made up the collaborative agreement. I don't know if you knew that, David. I don't know if you guys knew that, but we kind of made that up. So our attorneys, the city attorneys, the police union, and the Black community, we sat at the table, took 18 months to design, to fight, scream, argue, point fingers, you're at fault, get back on course, because of course, when you talk about policing and accountability, crime always comes up. And until police are held to the same standard as you or I, if we were to commit a murder, then it's not considered a crime. So I want to be clear. We were talking about reforming police. So they decided on the collaboration. And even at one point, when we thought we would have our attorneys file a breach of contract, because we had got what we wanted inside of the federal court, we decided that we would settle it, that we would not have a consent decree, that we would settle it based on policy, procedures, and guidelines. We would settle it on how we believe policing could get better for African Americans. We would create our problem-oriented policing, and there is a difference outside of community policing. We weren't talking about police officers.